Well, just very quickly, you know, it's interesting. We did this on Rosh Hashanah Yom Yunun, and all our speakers lived in Israel except for one. And today, somehow, all our speakers live in the United States except for one. You're the only one. You're an Israeli representative. So whatever. And as, of course, every reference October 7th and whatever, you should be strong. And thank you for hosting our son on Yom Tov for Rosh Hashanah for a meal. Invited him on the day itself. He didn't even know. Just told me thank you. And wish you knew. And it's a pleasure to see your mother here, Dr. Blau. I know, having had a Torah speaking earlier, how much pleasure a parent gets from listening to a child teach Torah. Rabbi Blau is the Rosh Yeshiva of Yeshiva Oraita. He spoke a couple years ago on, he's written on Agadah. That's a field of his. He writes a lot on Jewish issues. Always a pleasure to read. Rabbi Blau is going to speak, I think, very interesting. And I'm glad on the tshuva of Rav Huttner, Rav Yitzchak Huttner. And then following him, Nadi Helfgott's going to speak on Rav Lichtenstein. This is coincidental. I mean, they gave me topic. And of course, Rav Lichtenstein was a student of Rav Huttner before he came to YU. So that's actually, we'll see if there's any crossover. I don't know. But Rav Yitzchak Vakashat's all yours. And there are no source sheets. Before everybody starts yelling at me, why don't I post source sheets? There are no source sheets. Torah Shabbat Peh.
Okay, thank you, Rav Jay. It's great to be back. Before I get to the actual Torah, maybe I should just introduce a little bit of the biography of Rav Huttner and why I think he's an important thinker for us to know. So Rav Huttner was born in Warsaw, learned in the famous Mussi Yeshiva called Slobodka, and that was the yeshiva that emphasized the greatness of mankind, as opposed to Novartek. And that yeshiva actually started a branch in Hebron in the 1920s, which Rav Huttner went along with them. They are unfortunately the yeshiva students who were murdered in 1929. And that's why there's the oddity now of yeshiva called Hebron in Yerushalayim. I mean, that yeshiva moved to Yerushalayim. Rav Huttner was not in Hebron on that day, so he was not affected. He became close with Rav Kook, actually, while he was in Israel. And later, he really moved away from Rav Kook because I think Rav Huttner was not a very Zionistic rabbi. So he kind of moved away from Rav Kook. He moved to New York and became the Rosh Yeshiva of Chaim Berlin. And he was the Yeshiva of Chaim Berlin for a good 40 years, more than 40 years. And he was particularly known for his Jewish thought about around the holidays. I think it's interesting to think about if someone was to teach Jewish thought, they could use different structures. I think most of us would have topical organization, right? Oh, there is... Here's my discussion of providence. Here's my discussion of repentance. But Rav Huttner chose a different vehicle. He thought that Jewish thought is taught through the live example of the holidays. So there'll be a volume on Pesach, a volume on Rosh Hashanah. All the volumes of his work, Pachad Yitzchak, are about Chagim, with one exception. There's a volume of letters and articles. It wrote Umamarim, which I think is a great volume, but it's mostly the Chagim. It's just interesting to realize that Rav Huttner teach a thought through the Chagim. Secondly, I often feel that our world, let's say, what I know what you want to call it, our modern Orthodox world or the Tehillim world, we're kind of dominated by two thinkers. Like in American modern Orthodoxy, Rav Soloveitchik is a fairly dominant voice. And in the Israeli national religious camp, I think Rav Kook is a pretty dominant voice. Now, this is not a problem. Rav Kook and great thinkers. But it does raise a little bit of an issue in that there are a lot of other profound thinkers that we should be encountering. And I think perhaps particularly because Rav Huttner was more identified with the Haredi world, perhaps that's why, Adam, I'm curious how many people on this discussion have really encountered Rav Huttner's ideas before. So I think whether he was Haredi or not, or let's say he was Haredi, he was a very profound thinker, and it's only to our benefit to encounter some of his ideas. Okay, with that introduction, we can get down to business. So there are two pieces I want to do from there. Maybe I should just show people. It's classically blue volumes. If you see this in the Midrash, okay, this is what Rav Huttner's Pachad Yitzchak looks like. This is the Rosh Hashanah volume. Okay, so we are going to look at one piece from the Shavuos volume actually first, and then, time permitting, two pieces from Rosh Hashanah. Let's start with a piece from the Shavuos volume, and you'll see why it's relevant to Rosh Hashanah. Okay, so I'm just reading the comment for a second. Okay, great. Yes, he did spend time in Berlin. That is correct. Rav Huttner spent, apparently that was the place to be. If you were a Jewish intellectual in the late 20s and early 30s, you had to go to Berlin. Okay, so in any case, Rav Huttner raises the following question. Okay, well, first we'll start with a well-known question. They'll get to Rav Huttner's question. We just recited the Musaf Midah on Rosh Hashanah. And it's an unusual Shmona Esrei in that it has an unusual number of brachot, right? The weekday Amidah usually has 19 blessings. Shabbat and Yom Tov one, which changes the middle section, has 7. But specifically on Rosh Hashanah, 9. That's unusual. And it's because there are 3 themes that we want to get in there. Themes called Malchiyot, God is the king, Zichrono, God is the one who remembers, and Shofrot. Now, when we're saying, when we're expressing these themes, the way this happened to us, we have passages, but also psukim. Five psukim that express these themes. And there's a classic structure, and it's 3 psukim from Chumash, 3 from Tuvim, 3 from Nevi'im, and then 1 from Torah. Okay, so a 3-3-3-1 structure, beginning and ending with Chumash. That's all great. But all the commentaries want to know that the order seems a bit off, because we all know we have multiple Tanakhs. Tanakh means starts with Torah, then the prophets, then Nevi'im, and then Ketuvim. So it's a little bit unusual that we would recite the Psukim in order of Torah, then Ketuvim, then Nevi'im. Is that a well-known question? So I'll mention one other answer before I get to the answer that's really relevant to our discussion. Some have pointed out that we actually are going in chronological order. Because think about it. If we're quoting verses from Ketuvim to convey God's kingship or God's remembrance, they're probably not from, I don't know, Kohelet. They're probably not from Eov, right? No, they're all from Telem. That's where they came from. Okay, so Telem is traditionally attributed to David HaMelech. So that's pretty early in the game. Okay, conversely, when we get to the prophetic passages, okay, we're probably not going to quote from Nevi'im Rishonim, right? From the narrative of Yeshua and Shoftim, we're not going to get the right themes. But if we go to the poetic chapters of Yeshayahu, Yirmiyahu, Yechezkel, we sure will. So if it turns out that the Ketuvim Psukim are from Tehillim, i.e. David, the Nevi'im Psukim are from Yeshayahu, so of course the Ketuvim Psukim precede the Nevi'im Psukim. So one argument would be, we happen to be being chronological here, because we're not looking at Nevi'im and Ketuvim writ large. We're looking at Nevi'im and Ketuvim specific Psukim that we. Okay, great. There's another answer, though. People, you're all going to have a question on the other answer. I'm sorry, I'm going to ignore your question. But here's the other answer. The answer we're going to say is that we have a rule in Judaism called Malin Bakodesh Ve'en Moridin. We like to go up in sanctity, okay, not to go down. And apparently, Nevi'im have more sanctity than prophets are more sanctified than just the writings. And therefore, let's go from Ketuvim to Nevi'im. Now, every single person is out thinking, but Rabbi, if that's true, why in the world is Chumash first? I know that's a good question, but we're ignoring it. Okay, but the claim is that we want to go specifically from Ketuvim to Nevi'im because of Malan Bakodesh. Again, what is the assumption of that answer? The assumption of that answer is that prophetic books have more sanctity. Okay, file that aside. Now things are about to get exciting. Okay, what if I told you that some of the very same Rishonim who say that seem to take an opposite and contradictory position? Okay, I don't know if you ever thought about this question, but you know when it comes to stacking Svarim, so we're pretty adamant that other books should not go on the Tanakh or Chumash, right? I walk in and I see, I don't know, you put, even if I look or Fumar, if you put the Parfait Instinct on, say for Brinshit, I'm going to switch it around. No, Brinshit should be on top. Now, some people might think that you could extend this further in history, which is not true. And what would that mean? Maybe like, don't put an Achron on a Rishon. If you put the Yeshua on a Ritva, it's a disaster. That's not true. You could put the Yeshua on a Ritva. Okay, now let's go a step further. So some of the very same Rishonim who gave that first answer say, there's no problem putting a book of Ketuvim on a book of Nevi'im. If I put Kohelet on top of Sefer Shmuel, no big deal. Life goes on. Why? Because they're the same level of Dusha. Notice what just happened. You know, I'll put a name on it. The Ron happens to, Rabbeinu Nissim happens to say both things. Now we've got a clear contradiction, right? The Ron says on the one hand that, but if anyone has an answer, you can write it in the chat. Okay, the Ron says on the one hand, oh, when it comes to Rosh Hashanah recital of Psukim, let's do Ketuvim and then Nevi'im. Because we want to go up in sanctity. Prophecy has more sanctity. But then when we're stacking books, all of a sudden the same Ron says it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter what's on top because two women of them are just the same in terms of Kedusha. So what are we going to do with this contradiction? So I'm going to give just a general direction, and then we'll see exactly how Rav Hunter does it. So I think what most of us would try to do in this kind of scenario would be to say that there are different aspects being focused on. And when it comes to one category, then indeed, Nevi'im have more sanctity than Ketuvim. But if I look at it in a different category from a different angle, then they're just the same. But of course, that's easy to say. The million-dollar question is, what are those two categories? When do we have Nevi'im having more Kedusha? And when do we say they're just the same? Okay, so Rav Hunter says, I think, a really brilliant point. Let's start with the following. Prophecy. Where did it first find expression? So I think we have a sense that Yeshayahu HaNavi got up on the soapbox and he gave rebuke to the people. Why are you not being nice to the widows and orphans? Why are you acting like Sodom and Amorah? Right? That's what Yeshayahu did. Then what happened? This is a famous idea that prophecies that were needed for the generations. So we took Yeshayahu's oral discourse, his oral transmission, and we converted it into a book. Excellent. And maybe there's certain oral transmissions that never made it into book form, but sure, it was important enough that prophecies had both expressions. However, that's not our sense with Ketuvim. Right? Shlomo Melech did not get up on the streets of Jerusalem and proclaim Kohelet. Just a written text. It lacked that component. Now, I think this is very important. I'm not going to go into too much of a tangent here because I won't have time for other ideas. We should all think about modes of transmission. It's not an accident that our tradition has a Torah Shebal Peh and a Torah Shebichtav, a oral law and a written law. Because there are certainly major advantages to having things in writing. But I think for moderns, okay, just Reb Jay, someone asked about the sound. Are other people having trouble or
I
just
was
one
going
person?
to interrupt you, but I was going to write occasionally. I don't know. You go in and out a little bit. I mean, I follow everything you said. So maybe just, I don't know. That I can't do if it's an issue with the internet or closer to the microphone or whatever.
Okay, I'll try moving closer and see what we can do. Sorry about that, whoever made the comment. Okay, so there are certain, I think we moderns are so used to the idea we could access anything in written form. Okay, certainly the printing press played a role and the internet played a major role. But most of human history, a lot of wisdom was given over orally, right? I stood before a crowd and spoke. And there are certain advantages to that, right? You get my emotions, right? We're in the same room. There's a greater sense of connection, right? So at that point, we realize, well, there's really importance to the oral transmission and there's importance to the written word. Okay. Now let's go back to Nevi'im versus Ketuvim. Apparently, I could look at Nevi'im from two perspectives. One perspective would be the written word, a book. And another perspective would be going, hearkening back to the oral transmission of prophecy. Okay. Now let's go back to our table. When I have two books on the table, I'm relating to them as books. I'm relating to them as the written word. From the perspective of the written word, there is no difference between Nevi'im and Ketuvim. They are both holy books and they have an equal level of Kedusha. Okay. However, think about the Rosh Hashanah example. What am I doing on Rosh Hashanah? I'm reciting the psukim out loud. I'm giving verbal expression to the psukim. Ah, from that perspective, Nevi'im indeed has a whole level that Ketuvim does not. Nevi'im is this powerful oral transmission. Year, many, many centuries ago, Yeshayahu and Yirmiyahu gave over, and Ketuvim was never like that. So both halachot are true, and they're not contradictory. As books, as the written word, prophecy and Ketuvim are all the same. I could stack them on each other. When it comes to oral verbalization, no. Nevi'im has something Ketuvim lacks, and that's why it's more kadosh. And therefore, Malan B'Kodesh means going from Ketuvim to Nevi'im. Okay, this is idea number one. Before I move on to idea number two, let me just ask, Rav J, is the sound any better?
I think so. I think a little better. Yeah, just stay close to the mic. I don't know if the people
Okay.
agree, and speak loudly.
Okay.
It still keeps happening.
I'm glad the fast is over in Israel.
Okay, thanks. Okay, we're going to go on to idea number two. Okay. So Rav Huttner was also very sensitive to language. Okay, he really noticed fine distinctions in how I phrase something. So here we're going to do a great example. The Gemara in Rosh Hashanah. Okay, by the way, this is in the Rosh Hashanah volume. So there's a famous Gemara that talks about three books. There are three books that God, the heavenly accountant, opens on Rosh Hashanah. And it says that tzaddikim are signed, the righteous are signed for life. The wicked are signed for death. But then there's a middle group called the Beinonim, those who are not in the righteous camp or in the wicked camp. And they get a suspended sentence. It says they wait 10 days to see what happens. And in the words of the Gemara, Zachu, if they merit, then they're sealed for life. Okay, so it's a 10-day waiting period to see if they merit. Again, let's focus on the word. The word is Zachu, if they merit. Wait, now that's the Gemara in Rosh Hashanah. What happens when the Rambam quotes it? So the Rambam has the exact same three categories, but the Rambam says, oh, not im zachu. What happens if I'm in the middle? It says, im asu tshuva. If I repent, then I make it to the book, right? Then I'm good. Now, again, I said Rav Huttner is really sensitive to language. He is so curious. Why did the Rambam switch? Right? The Gemara's language seems just fine. Im zachu, if you merit. Why would someone prefer im asu tshuva? Okay. Now, obviously, we have to ask, what's the difference between the two formulations? What would zachu indicate? And conversely, what would asu tshuva indicate? Great. So let's think for a second. I'll ask the crowd. Which of the two do you think sounds broader? Sounds more narrow. You could answer in the chat, please. What sounds like a broader category that encompasses more? Is zachu to merit or asu tshuva? What do you think is a broader category? Let's see what we got here. We got a bold person to answer the question. Someone has to answer the question because otherwise my mother's going to feel pressure to answer. Okay, so what do you say? What is a broader category? Okay, thank you. That is the correct answer. Mom, you're free. You're so... Okay, excellent. Okay, so zachu sounds like it could be anything. Any good deed could be a... I could pray. Okay, very good. Neil Fleischman got it right also. Excellent. Okay, I could pray. I could study Torah. It's nothing. You all would fit into zachu. Tshuva seems much more focused. No, it's not about doing a mitzvah. It's about repenting. So why would the Rambam do that? Okay. So Rav Huttner says that maybe we're all making a mistake about this Gemara, because it's very tempting to be purely quantitative about it. I mean, what's the Gemara doing? It's giving a number to every mitzvah. It's giving a price to every avera. We put one on the scale, and we measure. It's extremely quantitative. I just point out, this is not Rav Huttner's argument, but it's hard to imagine that's what it really means, because if that's what it meant, that we're being purely mathematically quantitative about it, how many people in the world would actually be a Beinuni? Like, how could it be? How many, can you imagine that? We count up all my mitzvah and all my other, and I'm just even. I'm exactly at the midway point. It's hard to imagine there'll be like, you know, five people like that. So we'll have this very weird category of the Beinuni that really encompasses very little, very few people. So Rav Huttner says, no, you're making a mistake. We're not interested in this particular source. It's not a quantitative evaluation. Now, again, this doesn't mean that we don't care about quantitative evaluations. It's just not what we're doing right now. Character traits. Being a Beinoni is a mida benefesh. It's about who you are. And I'd like to explain a little bit what's going on here. I think Rav Huttner would say as follows. They're really people we know who are committed to goodness. That's what they're about. Ideals, that's what they care about. Okay, and you can encounter such people. There are people who, unfortunately, are dedicated to evil. I know Joseph Stalin. is where his heart is. But I think a good deal of humanity is kind of in the, for lack of a better term, the apathetic middle, right? They don't have great aspirations, nor are they particularly wicked. Muddling their way through life, right? They go to work, come home and watch some TV, like nosh a little. Terrible, but no great aspirations. That's what it means to be a Beinoni. We're not talking here about the math. We didn't calculate you in your 372 to 372. You're a Beinoni as a personality. That is who is in the middle group. So if Rev Hunter is right, let me first explain how it answers the question and then say why I think it's really a powerful idea. Okay, how does it answer the question? Well, again, if I'm in the mathematical camp, Zachu works, right? If I'm exactly even, any mitzvah will make the mitzvah side of the scale way more, and mitzvah win. So it doesn't matter. So the Gemara's formulation, Zachu, makes it seem very mathematical. But if it's about a character trait, in theory, I could do one more mitzvah, or one more Aveira, for that matter, and not really change. I'm the same person I always was. It happened to be, on the way home, I met a poor person and gave him some money. Right? So lo and behold, I'm now on the good side. But that's only mathematically. That doesn't mean I've really fundamentally changed. What would be about fundamental change? That would be about doing tshuva. Doing tshuva means, it's not that I did one act of mitzvah or aveira stature. It means I'm decided to change my life, to move in a different direction, to have more pious aspirations and goals. That's why Rav Hunter says, that's why Rav Hunter says, the Rambam says, asu tshuva. He's trying to move the calculation from a mathematical one to a qualitative one about who you are. Now, I think this is a powerful idea. I'll also say, something I've thought about a lot. Actually, you know, it's good because I can get 90 people there to give me suggestions. I'm trying to collect examples where in modernity, we like to put numbers on things. And that's often been very helpful. It helps science immensely. But what if there are certain things where numbering it doesn't get it, where there's a qualitative component, and when I try to force it into a rigid number system, it doesn't work. So I have a bunch of examples, and any of you 91 people have more, please let me know. I'll just do one very briefly. Okay, it's one of my favorite examples. Okay, let's say a professor is up for tenure. So universities have tried to make it very objective by putting numbers on things. Here are some of the numbers. How many articles has this person published? How many books has this person published? And to make it even better, they'll give a point system to different journals. So if I'm lucky enough to publish in the Harvard Theological Review, I get 5 points. After all, the word Harvard's in the title. But unfortunately, in the Jewish Quarterly Review, then I get 3 points. So now, so it's completely objective. But I think those of us who read scholarship will realize clearly that's the way to do it. Somebody could happen to publish a lot of articles and not be a great scholar. And it can be a scholar who's outstanding, who hasn't published that much. Some people don't love to publish, or they only publish when they think they have an earth-shattering impose a mathematical rigidity on something that it doesn't really belong. So that sometimes I think we do that in modernity. So that gives more room to this refiner. Some of calculating how we are doing Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur time, some is mathematical, of course, but don't make all of it mathematical. It's not just counting mitzvah and counting averot. It's asking, who am I in my deepest? What am I longing for? What am I aspiring towards? That's who I am. And therefore, it's asu tshuva and not zachu. Okay, we are now going to move on to the third one. I see I've got 11 minutes left. I can sneak in the third one. I also want to welcome, I see Rabbi Neddy Helfgott's joined us. So that's great. You have a good teacher waiting in the background here, guys. Okay, last one. Okay, so we just did a footnote, right? The first one was Shvuot Bet. Then we did Rosh Hashanah Yud Chet. We now go to Rosh Hashanah Bet. And here's something else I'm really interested in. Rav Huttner associates Rosh Hashanah with Chesed, meaning he starts with what he calls the Kutras HaChesed. The first 7 or 8 pieces of Rosh Hashanah are about benevolence and compassion. And Rav Huttner thinks that creating the world was the primordial act of chesed, the primordial act of compassion. God made a world so that other people could enjoy life. And therefore, that is the paradigm that every subsequent act of chesed is kind of following. So I'm just curious if Rav Huner is the first person to do this. I don't know if other thinkers thought that Rosh Hashanah's central theme is chesed. But that's how Rav Huner does posit. Okay, then Rav Huner says something you might find a little surprising, but I'm going to try to say why it makes sense. Rav Huner says the ideal chesed is one where nobody loses. Meaning, let's say I have three pieces of cake. If I give one to Rav J and one to my mother, I only have one piece of cake, right? It's a limited resource. When I do chesed, the other person has more and I have less. Rav Huner paints that as actually not the ideal form of chesed. Now, when I first read it, I was a little perturbed because that's a sacrifice, right? You give something up and don't have it anymore. But I think what Rav Huner is saying is I'm not measuring the biggest sacrifice. I am measuring what an ideal chesed would look like. And it's true, it's a bigger sacrifice to give something up. But in the ideal world, wouldn't it be great to have a chesed which is win-win, which nobody loses, right? The giver gains and the recipient gains. Okay, terrific. We'll get to what that is in a second. But that's what Rav Huner posits about the nature of chesed. And also, if it, right, God does not lose by creating mankind. So if the primordial act of chesed is God making the world, so then this idealized vision of compassion, which is win-win. Okay. Then Rav Huner quotes a pasuk in Mishlei and a Gemara in Sukkah. The pasuk famously says, her mouth is open in wisdom. The Torah chesed alishona. And a Torah of chesed is on her lips. Now, again, I said before, Rav Huner is an extremely close reader. He pays attention to words. Says Rav Huner, Torah chesed is not the same as Torah vichesed. What would it mean in terms of close reading? Torah vichesed means I have two disparate great values. I have Torah and I have chesed. Torah and chesed. In grammatical form, Torah chesed, Torah's modified chesed, adjective for chesed. So the two are impacted on each other. I have Torah and I've got chesed. I've got a Torah and chesed that are fruitfully interacting. Okay. I'll throw one last question to the crowd. Rav Huner said the ideal chesed would involve nobody losing. And we all agreed that in a material object like a piece of cake, so somebody loses. If I give you my cake, I don't have it. What do you think, guys? What would be a classic example to give you something and lose? That element of life and compassion and giving that I share with you, but I did not lose anything. Where does that take place? Okay, and again, someone has to answer to free up my mother from pressure. Okay, what do you say? When do you say I'm
before
sharing
Polin?
Before
Polin.
Okay, that's a good example, actually. Excellent. Besides, that's a very good example. Birkat Kohanim. Besides that, what would be a classic example?
There
we go. Usher Stein, way to go. Okay, I'm sorry, I happen to have been looking for Usher's answer. But okay. I see. Light, that's a good one.
Oh, excellent.
Okay, so let's go with Usher for a second. Okay, when I share wisdom with you, okay, so I still have it, right? I really like this idea from a funner. Now I've given it over to another 90 people. I didn't lose it as a result. But it's even deeper than that, because what could one claim when you share wisdom, right? We all know you learn something from teaching as well in many ways, right? You learn something because a student makes an interesting comment you had not thought of. You learn something because you're forced to explain it. Think carefully how to explain it. But in many ways, you know it much better. In fact, I'll even give you a rule. Jack mentioned that I write some articles. I never like to publish if it's something I haven't taught. Because I know if I taught it, then it was analyzed on a deeper level. I passed my ideas before some good critics, my students, some intelligent critics. And now I'm in a better place than I was with these ideas. And as a famous Gemara, you probably have heard it. I learned much from my teachers, more from my peers, and the most from my students. So Rav Huner says there's certain things. Okay, what's the split really? The material world is a limited resource. That's why anything I share that's physical, I give it up and I don't keep it anymore. I give you my piece of land. I no longer own it. But the spiritual world is not a limited resource. So just like I could share wisdom, I would say the same thing about someone said visiting the city. I would say sharing a smile. Like if I smile at you in the street and you're in a better mood now, like I didn't lose, arguably I'd lose from smiling at you. And so there also, there would be ability to share, an ability to give something where you don't really have any kind of loss. Okay, so says Rav Hunner again, let's review it all and get to the last answer here. So what do you have in Rav Hunner? You have this idea that the ideal chesed is one which everybody benefits, the giver and the recipient. That is following the primordial act of chesed that God made in the world, right? A win-win. And now let's go back. Okay, what did... Oh, I think I left something out, which is good. 4 minutes left. When the Gemara in Sukkah asked what Torah chesed is, the Gemara in Sukkah says, if I just learn Torah, that's Torah. But if I learn in order to teach, that's Torah and chesed. But let's now go back to Rav Huttner's inference. Rav Huttner said that this is not Torah and chesed. It is Torah and chesed. But based on the insight we just shared, it makes sense. Because now we're saying that the Torah and chesed impact on each other. Right? That because it's Torah and chesed, it's the kind of Torah, it's the kind of chesed, which is win-win. There is no loss. Right? If I gave you a piece of silk, it would be Torah chesed. Because then the chesed would not be modified. I'd have the lower form of chesed where there's a diminution, where there's a loss. But because it's Torah, then it's the idealized form of chesed. It's the chesed where nobody loses. That's why it can be categorized as Torah chesed rather than Torah v'chesed. Okay, let me sum up all 3 points and we'll see if there's a final comment. Hopefully, for those of you who have not encountered Rav Hunner, I hope this has convinced you that he is well worth encountering. Okay, and just for those who had trouble hearing me, I apologize, and I will get a better headset for next time, I guess. Okay, here we go. Number one, Rav Hunner taught us that Nevi'im have two elements. There's the written element, their books. From that perspective, they're just like Tuvim. But then they're the oral discourse. Their verbal transmission. That's something Ketuvim do not share. That's why in Rosh Hashanah and Musaf, the Nevi'im Psukim have more sanctity than the Ketuvim Psukim, even though on the table, I could stack them any way I want. Idea one. Idea number two, says Rav Huttner, you know what? That Gemara about the three books, stop being so mathematical about it. Beinuni is not somebody who's tied 640 to 640. Beinuni is about who you are, what your aspirations are. That's why the Rambam moves it from Zachu to Asu Tshuva. It's not about putting one more mitzvah on the scale. It's about changing your life goals. That's what it's all about. Okay, great. Idea number three. And again, I thought that was important for moderns because we very much get caught up in the mathematics. Anything could be put with a number. Again, it's been helpful in the world of science, but sometimes it's the wrong way to go about it. Finally, number three, says Rav Hunner, there's this ideal form of chesed, which is win-win. We don't experience it when we share in the material world, but we do experience it when we share happiness, when we share wisdom. That's when we experience, says Rav Hunner, that's what Torah chesed is. This beautiful combination. Again, it's not Torah and chesed, but a Torah and chesed that animate and impact on each other. Okay, I see it is 8:28, so I will ask Rav Jay if anyone would like to make a comment on any of the three ideas.
I think you've explained why chesed is matnat chinam, not mathematically, zero mathematically, a different category of gift. That's why it's called matnat chinam.
Okay, thank you. Dr. Heppner, are you trying to link the idea two and idea three together?
Am I trying to what?
Link the second idea with the third idea. Because exactly. You also made a qualitative, quantitative point.
Exactly. No, I want to say that you've explained to me why God responded to Moshe Rabbeinu the way that he did. He took Rav Huttner's Chiddush seriously and applied it to Moshe Rabbeinu.
Okay, terrific. See, we get good comments from Los Angeles on this chat group here.
Thank you.
Okay, anybody else?
Comments, questions, Dr. Shah? Okay, Rev Natty? Okay, thank you, Rev
my pleasure.
All right, a pleasure.
I just wanted to add
a little, that means you got to pay attention.
Rabbi Blau.
That's always good.
Jay, yes. Jay, I just wanted to add to Rabbi Blau. If I recall correctly, the Rambam himself, when he talks about, you know, when God judges the world, about, you know, he also moves it away from a purely mechanical, numerical judgment, where he says it's not half-half. It's, you know, some mitzvot and some averot can be worth much more than many others. So already inherent in the Rambam is this move away from a purely numerical when he, in a different context.
I don't know how close are those halakhas. When you said that, that's the beginning of a Perek Gimel in Hilchot Teshuvah, I think.
Right.
I don't know where, Yitzi, I don't know where your halakha, which halakha is that in the Rambam? What Perek? That I don't remember. But I know what Natty's talking about is the beginning of Perek Gimel.
Right.
I will say one thing. Rav Natty, great point. In the Rav Huttner piece, he actually does briefly address your qualitative point also. Right? Rav Huttner wants to go even beyond that. It's even more than the fact that some mitzvot are worth more, but he does mention it.
Right.
Okay, let me just look briefly where it is. Sorry. Rav Huttner puts the sources in the back. It is Perek Gimel Halacha Gimel.
So it's right after. They're back to back on the Rambam.
Yeah.